The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
All right, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL. And today we're going to be talking about advertising and consumption and consumerism and the quality of life in America today. And joining me here in the studio to talk about the show are two esteemed scholars and experts of sorts on the subject. First, on my left is Dan Cook. Dan is a professor in the Department of Advertising and the Department of Sociology here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and is the editor of a new book called
Symbolic Childhood.
Symbolic Childhood, which just came out in 2002. To Dan's left and to my right, and I mean that geographically, Jim, is James Twitchell, a visiting professor of advertising and English here at the University of Illinois in the fall semester of 2002. Jim teaches full-time and has for, I think, several years now at the University of Florida in the Department of English, and is a prolific author originally of English, but over the past decade or so moving gradually towards issues of consumption, of advertising, of luxury goods in your most recent book. Jim, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Now, before we get started, Jim, just so people will understand what's going on here, you are an English professor, and I looked through your list of books. It's a very impressive list, and the first couple on the list are right out of what you'd expect an English professor
when to write about. When I was a good boy doing my job.
Yeah, you got tenure. And you
and then all of a sudden, I don't know what happened, that little imp of perversity got into me, and I...
This is when you said, thank God for tenure. Right?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking.
Okay.
But I went from stories of high culture, stories that we call literature, to stories of low culture, stories that we call advertising. Same thing, really. It's just stories about different stuff.
Mm-hmm. And you've written now, Ad Cult USA was the first book of yours where I became familiar with your book, and that was published in 96 or 7?
Well, I have no idea. I've been writing the same book over and over.
You said that, okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, I say it because I think it's true. Academics do that. You have a paragraph that you meet, and you just keep banging on it until finally it gives up or you give up.
You know, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I absolutely
think. Really, I mean, for me, it's about, all about stories.
Yeah.
Why do certain stories hang around, and why do other stories go away?
Mm-hmm.
And what does it take to keep certain stories in sort of front mind? And why are advertising stories front mind stories?
In your most recent book, and we're not here to pump it up too much, but I think it should be mentioned, is Living It Up, Our Love Affair with Luxury. Just came out, published by Columbia University Press, which has published most of your books recently on advertising. And Dan, turning to you now for a sec, tell us a little bit about your book and the sort of work you do in advertising.
Well, Symbolic Childhood is a compilation of 12 chapters by various scholars, mostly North American but also European, which look at how childhood is used as a symbolic or rhetorical arena for the invocation of various values, moral values, and perspectives on social life. So a number of the chapters deal with advertising and consumption, but some look at the child in history and how in, say, one chapter in Canadian history, how children were used as sort of symbols of the new nation. Mm-hmm. And of the sort of modern nation and a number of things like that. So it's an interesting collection of how childhood is used in those ways.
And is this where your own research and writing deal with issues like this as well?
Well, my own research and writing deals with how children have entered into the world of goods and consumption in the 20th century. And in a lot of ways, I see children as being invoked and used as symbols, as well as being actual subjects of consumption, actual people who go out and purchase things, but as they are sort of figured in advertising, and they're addressed more or less as symbols representing something else other than children.
Now, you were this summer, if I'm not mistaken, in 2002, you had an opportunity to spend some time in Chicago at the Leo Burnett Agency, one of the largest advertising agencies and most famous advertising agencies in the world. And what did you learn about how the advertising agency, you know, how it regards the children market, how seriously it takes it? You know, what did you learn there?
Well, I think Leo Burnett takes the children's market quite seriously. They have an entire sort of offshoot that they call Kid Leo, which is a research unit that does what they consider general research on children, not for any particular client, not for McDonald's or anywhere else, because they want to sort of study children and understand, you know, what are children thinking of various ages? What are they doing? How do they express themselves? And then the various units of Leo Burnett, if it's a McDonald's or if it's Toys R Us or Crayola, may draw upon that research and use it or take off of it and do particular research for a particular client and a campaign.
I remember talking to you when you came back from the internship over at our house. You came by and you were talking about just really how extraordinary the sort of resources and thought that went into this sort of unit to really get inside children's heads to figure out how you could sell them stuff, what it would take to work, really starting at a pretty early age. And at that time, you spoke of it, I wouldn't say necessarily in a negative term, maybe almost in awe, but it was striking to you. I guess you didn't really fully appreciate. Is that fair to say?
Sort of it's definitely fair to say. I didn't appreciate not only for children, but just the amount of resources that a place like Leo Burnett, and I know there's many others like them and smaller gradations, but the amount of resources, knowledge, and sort of concentration on market segments, and in this case, children we're talking about, that when you come from a university, and even if you come from a wealthy university, which I do think the U of I is compared to many others, we have resources. We have a wonderful studio here for radio and all of those sorts of things. No one could compete with the kinds of ability to go out and talk to consumers, to observe them, to calculate all of these sorts of dimensions of their lives. But one other thing, if I just could put this in, is it wasn't only those kinds of monetary resources, but how thoughtful, intelligent, and reflective many of the people were there. Surprised me, not because I thought people were stupid or anything like that, but because I really sensed that a lot of our society's resources go into this activity we call advertising and marketing.
Yeah, it's funny. Seth Jolly, who's been a guest on the show in the past and is one of the leading sort of scholars of advertising and quite critical of advertising. I don't know. Is he in your book, Jim, by the way?
Oh, yes.
Oh, good. Okay.
And in my life as well.
Okay, in your life as well. Well, he talks about, along those lines, Seth Jolly likes to talk about how, a 30-second advertisement on television, you know, has vastly greater resources and thought that goes into it than equivalent 30 seconds in a movie or a television program. That, you know, really people don't fully grasp just the amount of thought that goes into it and really the great talent behind these advertisements. And in that way, you and Sud, although I think you are part company on several issues, probably agree. Because, I mean, your argument, Jim, if I understand it, is that, in fact, the television advertisement or advertising in general really is this sort of unrecognized cultural force.
Yes, but more to the point, it's not just television advertising, it's television advertising toward young people. The absolute center of gravity in an advertising culture are people who have not yet started to buy. So you're not advertising just because you want to sell them a meat patty. You're advertising to kids because you never, from an advertising point of view, put your pitch out at the time of consumption. You always do it before. So if I wanted to get you, Bob, to change your toothpaste or your shampoo.
Or even start using toothpaste.
Or even start using toothpaste or even shampoo what hair we have, it would be maybe $300 of advertising money directed just at you. But if I want to get a 14-year-old to start using a toothpaste or drink a beer or smoke a cigarette.
Or a 7-year-old.
Clearly, everything has to move way before the moment of purchase, mm-hmm. which is why childhood is the absolute center of advertising gravity. It is the Valhalla of almost all advertising.
Now, I'm Jim Twitchell. I'm having some cognitive dissonance here because when I hear you say stuff like that and I hear Dan say what he just said, there's a side of me, and maybe it's this sort of elitist thing I've got going on that I'm trying to deal with, that says this doesn't sound real good to me, that we're putting all this energy going at kids.
Yeah, when my chunky 50-year-old friends look at me and say, what has gone on?
Are you describing someone in this
room? No, I'm just describing all of us. I'm describing the world of middle age.
Yeah.
When they look at me and they say, how did you let this happen? How come you lost your professorial role? I always say the same thing, which if you want your culture to move away from kids, here's what you have to do. Every time you go into the store, you have to change the brands you buy. Every time you think about a car, forget Volvo, forget Saab. You got to go out and buy something you haven't even thought of. You have to act like a teenager. Then culture will move to you. And it's simply a rule, if you will, of advertising that you want to get someone before they've made their brand choice. Look at any magazine for kids.
Yeah.
You'll see that they're selling hair coloring, not because the kids' hair need coloring, but because look at 17 magazine. That's where Clairol sells hair coloring.
And 17, of course, is read by girls who are 11 and 12.
Exactly. And who will have to wait.
I guess
a
if
good...
you want 11-year-olds or 3-year-olds to read it, you call it 11 magazine.
Well, whatever. But the key is that if you look at the people in the ads, they're not 35-year-olds. They're 25-year-olds who are changing their hair color, and it's being advertised to 11-year-olds.
Now, Jim Twitchell, what do you think about, and Dan, too, you can chime in, too, on this one. What do you think about these sort of spoil sport countries like Sweden and Greece that don't allow any advertising on television to children under 12? They say that that's immoral. I mean, are they sort of, what are they doing? Are they throwing a monkey wrench? Are they fighting nature? Is this a force of nature they're battling? I mean, what do you make of those countries that do stuff like that?
Wonderfully hopeless.
Wonderfully hopeless.
I
mean, ultimately,
I'm so much in favor. And yet I know it's dire.
Mm-hmm.
Look, the only people who have sufficient money and time to really listen to advertising are adolescents. I got plenty of money. I got a huge amount of time. You can't advertise to me. I'm over the edge.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of this, Dan? I mean, you've actually done a lot of studies of children and these issues. Is that what Sweden and Greece have done and what several other countries in Europe are now considering to make television advertising to kids under 12?
Well,
whatever age you might pick.
Well, it might be wonderfully hopeless in the sense about trying to stop them from consuming. I don't think that that's the point. I mean, people one of the problems with the discussion about consumer culture and children's consumption in general is that somehow the debate has gotten polarized that the people who are critical of advertising and consumption think that no one should do it, that we shouldn't consume, and all consumption and all advertising is bad or negative, or as someone else put it recently, the evil empire. But I think what it does is allows people to pause and think about and make choices about what kind of advertising should be done, what kinds of consumption, making consumption and advertising and the messages therein at least reflect upon them as choices, and as opposed to something that appears to many of us in this society is something that comes from above and is always part of our environment. And when you try to teach this kind of stuff to undergrads who are 19, 20, 21 years old, they have developed critical faculties, it takes a long time to get them to step out of the frame and to be able to look back on their own society and sort of understand that these messages are coming at them from particular sources with particular kinds of interests.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580. My guests are Dan Cook, who you just heard, and Jim Twitchell, both scholars in advertising, both with new books out on the subject. And we're going to be talking about advertising and consumption this hour. This is a pre-recorded show we did shortly before going on air so we could do it in the studio together and work our schedules out. As a result, please don't try to call in and ask your questions. Today's a day to sit back, turn up the volume, make some tea, and let the professional yakkers do all the yakking, and you can just consume today. No, not a two-way flow. You know, one of the fundamental questions about advertising, and I'd like to throw it out to both of you, if it is like this tidal wave that's irresistible or what it represents, you know, how come it took humanity 90,000 years to figure that out? I mean, why is it, you know, it's an economic factor at least. You know, it was a really marginal activity in the 19th century, 0.3% of the GDP in 1865. It's 2-3% ever since 1920. I mean, what did humanity just sort of get hit over the head in 1890? Hey, we need to hear about bathtubs or something. I mean, what, you know, why is it such a recent phenomenon then if it's such a natural thing and so irresistible?
One word, the machine.
I love it. Those two words.
Well, the machine. Let's just say machine.
Okay, good. Or
this. This is what happens halfway through the 19th century. The application of steam to production means that stuff is going to come out of the other side of the factory, which will be just like the stuff coming out of any other factory. The only way to separate interchangeable stuff, called fungibles, is to tell a story about them. That's essentially why advertising starts with mass production. Because if this meat patty is that meat patty, if this pair of socks is that pair of socks, then I've got to say this one makes you sexier or this one lasts longer. I have to make up a fiction, a story, literature about stuff. So the big merchandiser of surplus goods before the 19th century was, of course, the church. They sold salvation in the next world. That's what you bought and you took possession after death. And essentially what happens after the Civil War in this country is surplus stuff always comes after wars, and you got to get rid of it. You start telling stories. Very often you pick up bits and pieces of the previous dominant storytelling, religion, and you start applying it to stuff. So this stuff makes you somehow...
So actually you're making more of a, if I understand it, it's more of a socialist argument here in the sense that you're not saying it's unchangeable. You're saying it goes with a certain type of political economy.
It goes
as long as you have that political economy.
It goes with a certain kind of production economy.
Yeah.
All you have to do is produce a surplus. You'll get advertising. You've got to. The only alternative is to cut your price.
Yeah.
You'll soon go out of business.
Well, yeah, in a capitalist economy. So, I mean, it's a argument about a type of political economy. So as long as you've got that, advertising's mandatory. So that's sort of a...
Bingo.
That's it. Okay.
Bingo.
But you're not a socialist, though, are you?
Oh, my gosh, no.
No, you're not. You think this is just fine.
Well, I'm not saying this is just fine. I'm just saying that as I walked across campus, I see these elderly gentlemen passing out Bibles, and I'm realizing, hey, they're in the business of telling stories. They've got one story. They're telling it. I pass on my way to the studio, the Golden Arches, and I say, whoops, what's going on there? You deserve a break tomorrow is what the men passing out the Bibles are saying, and you deserve a break today is what Ronald McDonald is saying.
Yeah, you know, there's some problem. Let me ask you, Dan. Let me just – or do you want to say something like that before we go on?
Well, I mean, partly, and I don't know what you're going to ask on this, but, I mean, part of – the concern I have when I hear analyses like Jim just gave, which on the whole is clearly right on, is that all of these stories are not equal in that way. They may appear equal to the individual person who's walking down the street. Now, I can take a Bible here, or I can take a Big Mac there, but they're produced in different contexts and different power structures. The kinds of stories I might want to tell about goods, or the kinds of stories that might have been told about goods before industrialization, because there were stories about goods from tribal society. We know about fetishes and totems and all other kinds of things. There's been stories about things for a long time. Has to do with not only the productive capacity that emerges, but the capacity to incorporate and sort of take over means of for lack of a better word, communication. And the stories aren't, as you mentioned, aren't only about goods, but they become stories about people and social relationships,
oh,
which I know you'd
agree. Oh, Dan, I totally agree. Listen, when I'm doing my job, I'm telling stories. I'm trying to sell something. What I'm selling is a view of culture that moves through high literature. In other words, I'm selling romantic poetry.
Although
I don't think about it that way. I'm trying to move stories out. What you don't realize is that I'm also distressed when I see that the stories that I loved and still do are essentially being drowned out. But there's another way to look at it, and that is that these are just stories in competition. Now, withholding judgment for a second, certain kinds of stories clearly are making their way through because somebody's pounding the drum really hard, namely commercial advertisers Leo Burnett. But these stories also exist because there's an audience that wants to hear them. Now, my audience, when I go to teach my class, really is not particularly interested in what's in a Wordsworth poem. They care more about what's in a Big Mac. I may not like that. In fact, I don't like that. But I have to deal with it. I can't pretend, oh, dear, this is terrible stuff. I have to try to figure out, why is this other language essentially colonizing so much space? And it's clearly because it's a two-handed game. All stories depend on storytellers and an eager tell-me audience.
But I think people – I understand that people want It may appear that students want to know more about the Big Mac, but I think sometimes we all can sort of fall prey to that kind of idea that you know, the young people today, and we've talked about it, you know, are you know, so thoroughly embedded in consumption and advertising that they really don't know anything else. And I guess my argument, and maybe I'm naive, is that there's ways to give alternatives to these kinds of narratives. And once they're sort of confronted by possible other ways of looking at things themselves, goods and others, that the Big Mac is still important and you're still going to eat it. But
Okay, at the end of my class, they've had the best that I can give about Wordsworth, Shelley, Keats, Byron. Now they have a choice. They have a choice between, hey, are they going to watch Jackass on MTV or are they going to pick up Shelley? They're going to watch Jackass on TV. In other words, though it's embarrassing to admit, the vibrant, vital, kinetic stories that are told in advertising, the train crash stories, the Anna Nicole Smith stories, are powerful.
I'm a little confused here because what you're doing is sort of conflating advertising per se, the selling of a product, in the way it's sold, like a Big Mac or Pepsi, with just the general commercial media. Is that fair? It seems like the examples you're giving, Anna Nicole Smith or Jackass.
Well, I'm just saying that excitement exists inside stories, and it's very hard to separate.
But, I mean, theoretically, I would think you could do, not that I necessarily you'd want to, you could do an Anna Nicole Smith show or a Jackass without having any ads on it.
I mean, You could.
I mean, there's nothing written into the code. In
Absolutely.
Fact, BBC actually has some fairly inane shows that have
which,
no advertising.
Many of which we've picked up and lettered ourselves.
But there's a slight difference there.
What I was responding to was Dan saying, these stories are keeping us from other stories. And my point is, I grew up with that symphonic music was better than rock and roll. I grew up in the 50s. That, I don't know, that Impressionism was better than cartoons. I grew up with this real deep faith from a family that truly believed it. And then I began to realize a lot of these distinctions were really social distinctions. They were ways to keep groups apart, to say Beethoven's Fifth is somehow better than
Roll Over Beethoven.
Roll Over Beethoven or Elvis's First. And I began to realize, okay, if we just withhold for a while judgment, see what these stories do, we'll see that they do different things for people at different times in their life. Mm-hmm. That's my current view, is that we go through a kind of natural consumption process. It's not happenstance that 40-year-old women are voluntary simplifiers. They've already gone through the consuming. Now they're pulling back.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today. Our guest, Jim Twitchell, whose voice you just heard, Dan Cook. Jim is visiting the University of Illinois this term in the Department of Advertising and the Department of English. Dan is a faculty member in the Department of Advertising here and also the Department of Sociology. And we're talking, as you can tell, about advertising consumption. This is a pre-taped show because we wanted to get them both in the studios when our schedules would work. So don't call in today. Just sit back and listen and let us do the yakking. As I was listening to you just now, Jim, it occurred to me that you know, we're sort of getting a lot of different things, like the high-low culture debate, which you were just talking about. There's another debate that is closely related, but I think is also distinct. And when you push them together, it sort of, I think, gives advertising a free ride that it doesn't necessarily deserve because it gets lumped in with the populace, which is the whole question, and this is a question that emerges when you deal with popular musicians all the time and entertainers and actors and writers, of the effect of sort of commercial values on creative content. And how that works. That whole relationship is a very complex relationship. But at the one hand, I mean, the key difference is that, sure, your book that you wrote and an advertisement for Marlboro cigarettes are both just stories. And there was this tales. You know, there's the guy and the horse, and it's Jim Twitchell's book. But the guy and the horse is there because someone paid him to be there. And if someone else paid him more to do an anti-smoking ad, he'd do an anti-smoking ad. If they paid him to go do an ad for Camel cigarettes, he'd do a Camel cigarette ad. And it's purely bought and sell. Truth is to the highest bidder. Your book, I don't think is that. I mean, I think
can we just stop there for
a moment? No, let's finish
the point.
All right, go ahead. This is a very important point. This is not a joke around point.
Okay.
To the extent that you have a society in which commercial values are so enmeshed that when you don't know if someone's just telling something because they've been paid to say it or because they actually believe it. When we lose that distinction, when you don't know if someone wrote a song because they were paid to write it to sell a product or because they actually came from their heart. Is that an important loss to you, or is that just irrelevant?
Well, it's not a silly point. It's a crucial point. Would academics write books if there were not a reward system?
Yeah, but does that mean, therefore, you throw everything out? You can't distinguish between them?
No, but I'm just saying that it's...
Well, obviously, everyone's going to write for a reward system. But I mean, but I don't understand what that has anything to do with the point I'm making.
Well, you just said that I wrote this book, assuming that I wrote this book out of an evolutionary zeal that somehow I couldn't stop.
No,
actually,
no,
we all do things...
Well, you wrote it because you believed it. You believe what you wrote here. And that's a distinction. Someone reads this book and they know someone's soul is in this book. When I pick up my Marlboro ad, I know they're just cooking up whatever they can to turn me upside down and shake the money out of my pants. Yeah. And if we confuse those two things, if the entire culture is just turning people upside down and shake the money out of their pants, and then let go, what happens?
Okay, so you're saying that creativity somehow gets sidetracked when it sells out to the highest bidder. Or at least at some level.
Well, yeah, there's some level of integrity is completely lost, that anything goes in the pursuit of money.
Yeah.
They sell, and that's what the whole advertising is all about.
What about the Renaissance
artist?
No
one believes Michael Jordan thinks Gatorade is better than 7-Up. They just know that Gatorade paid Michael Jordan $40 million.
Yeah.
And if 7-Up paid him $40 million one, he'd be selling a 7-Up's best.
Would Michelangelo have painted the Sistine Chapel if he were not remunerated by the Pope?
Yeah, but would Michelangelo, if someone had come in and said, hey, Mike, I'll give you 50 kroners, whatever the hell the currency was there, 50 whatever it is, if you draw a picture of, you know, my butt up there and put it next to the god. Would he
well, of course, that happens.
No, but would he have done it? I mean,
well, of course, the Medici actually get themselves into
his
paintings.
I understand there's a gradation here, but I think there's also a fundamental distinction, too. At least I think artists see it. Maybe, you know.
Romantic artists do. Modern artists do. I think prior to the 19th century, artists didn't.
But we didn't have commercialism in the sense we have it today. I mean,
I don't know. You see, I see religious.
Who were the Leo Burnett?
The ecclesiastical plasma, namely the church and what's inside the church, is being very close, really quite analogous to what happens when you go inside the grocery store. In other words, churches competed, the various secondary orders of the Holy Roman Church competed. One of the reasons you got the cathedrals erupting in the 15th century was that these competing groups trying to build bigger and bigger packages finally erupted with the cathedral. Inside, in some ways, a lot of that ecclesiastical art is a kind of advertising that went to, oddly enough, the Franciscans or the Jesuits who paid the highest bidder.
Once again, I just want to follow up this point on religion, because I don't know a great deal about religion beyond what I was taught growing up. But, I mean, my sense was, and I certainly don't know the Catholic Church as well as you do, but my sense is that while, you know, that when Martin Luther came along, say, the Reformation, which I studied a great deal, you know, these guys actually believe that stuff. It wasn't like Martin Luther said, hey, let's have a brainstorming session and see what we can cook up to get a bunch of Germans to sort of come our way. Let's see, how many saints do we need? No, saints, that's not going to work. We did some focus group tests. People don't want saints. You know, my sense was they actually believe this stuff. I mean, it came from the soul.
Martin Luther's great claim was a vehement response to the church's selling of indulgence. It's an absolutely crucial, from an advertising point of view, it's an absolutely crucial moment, because what he is saying is this product that's being sold should no longer be sold. It's got to be stopped. And what's an indulgence? An indulgence is working very much like an advertising promise. It allows you not to get to heaven. It allows you to get slightly ahead of your neighbor. And, of course, the breaking up of the Catholic Church with the Reformation into the various denominations, once again, from an advertising point of view, has a lot of rather intriguing, we won't go into them unless you want to, developments, but you start getting denominations.
I don't want to go into
No, you don't. I don't blame you.
Let's let Dan cook in here, or else I think this is the religious hour on public radio.
Well, I mean, you guys hit on just a ton of different kinds of points. I guess there's several things I would like to throw into this mix. I always have a problem when someone takes the language and the structures of thought of today and then sort of applies them backwards. And to call everything, to call any kind of activity that one gets money for or any kind of form of persuasion as advertising and consumption and selling across time and social context, I have a hard time calling them all the same sorts of things, because then it does put it back into a kind of naturalistic human nature kind of thing. Like advertising has always been with us in one way or another. It's just that now we have the mechanisms and we have the overproduction that we needed so much that it becomes ubiquitous and strong. So I have a problem with that for a number of reasons. But I think one of the distinctions, if we have to think about what's particular about today and what is part of it, really does have to do with the complete overwhelming of structure of thought that sort of what I just said. It's the overwhelming structure of thought that allows us to put everything into buying, selling, and advertising terms. So I think what Bob was trying to bring up is the way we work now is that we always that all sorts of discussions, whether it's art, whether it's sport, whether it's what kind of school I go to, whether it's religion, because I know you study a lot about the relationship between commerce and religion. It is sort of necessarily encompassed in an idiom of commerce. We can't get out of the idiom of buying and selling and advertising.
Let me get back to your book, Jim, because one of the core arguments in here, and you sort of alluded to it already in the show, is that the people who are critical of advertising and consumption, and specifically I think you're referring to luxury consumption, which looks sort of dubious, people buying products that aren't really necessary, but they spend the money just for the heck of it. You're quite critical of them in this book, in your most recent book, Living It Up, Our Love Affair with Luxury, as sort of elitist. Is that a fair assessment? What do you spell out what your critique of academic critics of consumption, of luxury consumption?
Spell it out. Okay, I'll do it.
Since so many of our listeners are probably fall into that group, be careful.
Yeah, I'll sort of do it. I'll do it on the fly.
Okay.
But stop me if I get too far afield.
If I pay you some money, will you check your argument?
Of course I will.
Okay.
I'll write any book you want. Human beings want meaning. That's what we're after. When we have relatively few objects, we posit meaning very often in the next world. If you look at images of heaven, you'll see that in relatively small material cultures, they have elaborate views of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
We have, in the last 150 years, done an incredible sort of down marketing of promise. We have moved meaning from the world beyond to this world. And we've done it, oddly enough, in the history of advertising because many of the characters in the 19th and 20th century came from a religious background. Early advertising guys, almost without exception, either studied for the ministry or were ministers. They understood the language of promise. They understood meaning. Meaning is what we're after. Whoever can attach meaning to something will carry our attention. Relatively few things, the priests will carry our attention, and the meaning will be put in the next world. With lots of stuff, you'll start finding that meaning starts glomming onto objects. You'll start finding the labels moving from the inside of the shirt to the outside. Polo ponies appear, nameplates of cars appear, everything outside. This is, I think, because humans are profoundly confused. We come into the world confused. Anyone who can somehow say, here, this is the way, this is the word, this is the path, this is the purpose, we'll pay attention. We've gone from one kind of strange religion to another kind of strange religion. Who knows? I mean, this one may very well evaporate. In fact, I suspect it will evaporate. But while it's here, it's traveling around the world at the speed of light, television.
And the people who criticize it then?
Well, I think first you have to understand it. Yeah. Very often things that come into this world and criticized as luxury. For instance, the medium that we're now using when it comes in the 1920s was thought to be unnecessary, as in my own field were novels. Novels were criticized as luxury. Mm-hmm. Indoor plumbing criticized as luxury. Of course, things like air travel criticized as luxury. Now we take them as necessities. In fact, one of the government's hallmarks for poverty is, do you have indoor plumbing? 100 years ago, my goodness, people said, you don't need indoor plumbing. No big deal. But just be careful when you hear the invocation of luxury. Very often what it means is something that I think you shouldn't have, but that if you give me a chance, I just as soon have it.
So it's middle class and upper middle class people who are decrying.
And it's also people of my age, people who are in their 50s who have already consumed quite a bit, very often tend to enter what I'm in already. I don't buy anything. I buy almost nothing. We turn against the world of consumption, and pretty soon, if I continue as I am predictably going to. I'll come to the point of my grandparents who, when I'd walk into their house and leave, they would always be giving me something. Here, take this, take this, take this. And I was always confused. Why do you want me to take that junk? And now I realize it's because we go through a natural gathering of stuff, using of stuff. Now I'm turning away from stuff. And pretty soon, I may very well get quite aggressively, the word is decaffecting, decaffected of stuff. I don't want it. Get it away.
Now, it's your criticism of people who sort of are individual moralists who are basically saying, you, Joe Smith or Sally Jones, you shouldn't consume that stuff.
Especially academics because, yeah. Of course, the whole academic bivouac is based on the fact that we know something. Well, we do. We do. And that it's better than yours. See, ironically, I think it is. But that you should stop doing yours and come over here.
But what about a broader social critique of consumption on environmental grounds?
Oh, forget it. I'm out of here. You're absolutely right. No, you're absolutely right. Is it wasteful? Are the externalities of consumption terrible? Yes. Is Ralph Nader correct? Yes. Are the Greenies correct? Yes. But having accepted that it has real terrible problems, try to figure out why is it so powerful that knowing that it has this back end, we seem to be unable to turn down the volume.
But it certainly doesn't hurt when you've got world-class people like Leo Burnett Agency spending, you know, tens of millions and billions of dollars trying to make us feel that way. That doesn't have any effect.
No, you're getting into the hypodermic theory about their making us.
Why do they have to spend all that money then?
Let me jump into this a little bit. I mean, Jim has the sort of he does have a sort of positive theory of human nature that people want things, attach meanings to goods, and we find ourselves in this kind of world that has all kinds of goods and all kinds of meanings, and so we're sort of into it. And in lots of ways, I agree with that. I don't think advertising or consumer culture has done too much on a fundamental level to change human beings. What it has done is it has usurped a number of kinds of activities that used to go on in the smaller group, that used to go on in the village or something beyond sort of a mass society kind of way. And so what happens with children is that, of course, kids want things. Kids manipulate objects. They see colors. They have social relations with a number of things. But the sort of originator of meaning and the originator of the images of meaning and the association between this idea and this product comes from somewhere outside of a smaller social circle than it had before. It does begin to originate in tall buildings in downtown Chicago and in boardrooms among young executives and in focus groups and a number of other sorts of things. And what is the interesting play that happens with advertising and consumption and the whole strength of the elitist argument, which Tom Frank called market populism of the 1990s, that if you ever criticize anyone for doing anything with their money, you are being an elitist, is that the whole strength of it all is that it appears to be and it is posited as sort of complete, open, and free choice, which is one of the highly valued
liberal values of our
society. So we can have choices among goods. My concern, and I think what I was trying to get at before when I was bumbling around, has to do with my critique and my understanding is not whether, you know, you buy one thing and someone buys another and I like this good or I like literature or any of those things. It's about how the parameters of choice are set and how they are guarded, about how we can think about something, how you can get people to be critical, not necessarily in a complaining about way, but critical in the sense of questioning the frame in which we come to see choices as choices, whether something sort of makes us better or worse.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. That was Dan Cook. And also in the studio with us today is Jim Twitchell. Well, this is a recorded show. We did it in the studio shortly before we went on air, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back and enjoy the next 10 minutes. Jim, you got a response to that?
Well, you know, so much of me, so much of my heart is with you guys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am an academic. That's one of that's the mortarboard that I wear. The other part of me is suspicious of it. I'm saying, okay, you don't want Leo Burnett to tell you, but you don't mind if the church down the street tells you. Someone is always telling us, and that's because we clearly want a message.
You were a socialist before, now you're an anarchist. Before we leave here, we're going to have the FBI strip searching you.
I'm simply someone who is saying these are stories. These are stories that are in a kind of Darwinian competition. It's clear that certain kinds of these stories, maybe it's because the Vatican is pounding on my ear with it, maybe because it's Leo Burnett's pounding on my ear with it, but it seems to me that one of these things that's crucial is to realize that we call this stuff goods, as in goods and services. We don't call it bads, because one of the traits, I think, of humans is we like
God.
Well, is we like stuff. If we have a chance to get to stuff, we'll go after it. One of the reasons why this commercial culture is moving brutally across all kinds of indigenous cultures and disturbing their storytelling is because it's really potent. Mm-hmm. And attaching it to caffeinated sugar water is, you may not like it, but at least you have to acknowledge it. And here's my point. You need to study it, mm-hmm. not just to whine about why no one's listening to you, but actually, why are they listening to Leo Burnett? I admit it's because he has a deeper pocket than you. But it may also be because the stories that he's telling about this hunk of pig iron that we're driving around in, there are stories, and the hunk of pig iron may be something that we actually, this is embarrassing for an academic to admit, we actually are intrigued by.
Mm-hmm. Material goods.
Yeah, that maybe we are. Maybe we do like things. Maybe we ought to admit it. We actually like, we hoard things, we steal things, we bury things, we trade things. It's hard for me as a literature professor to acknowledge this, but this is the stuff, mm-hmm. not daffodils and rainbows and 1,001 violin strings, but we really...
But that's not always the choice. I mean, you seem to set things up as either sort of very high culture or very...
No, it's both and. It's both and.
But it seems like you sort of set up the distinction. It's either, you know, immersed in Anna Nicole Smith or
no.
violins and high literature.
No, you got me wrong.
Okay.
No, there you have
okay.
me wrong.
Okay.
No, it seems to me that the natural human life goes through various periods. And childhood, the period that you're particularly... Mm-hmm. adept understanding is a period of real powerful material magnetism, and that as you go up, you move farther and farther away from it until finally you get to the point where literature, I mean, you know, Yeats says it. He says, you know, that's no country for old men. And I think he's right. As you grow up, you go into other stories. It's not either or.
But what people don't understand, and part of the difficulty of studying children and consumerism, is that everybody wants to jump on the, oh, our kids are exploited bandwagon. And first of all, I'd say yes, but let's study it. And part of what happens is that we do move through these periods, and if we want to understand why has consumption and advertising become so prominent and ubiquitous and accepted, as Bob asked at the very beginning of this program, one has to think about not just childhood and looking at a kid right now, but thinking about children in the 1910s and 20s who grow up beginning to get a certain sort of relationship to the world of goods as social relations are changing, and they become parents, and their children do, and as marketing and consumer culture increasingly finds it legitimate to move down the age ladder and to accommodate and to structure retail spaces and to structure goods for children, it becomes part of the life course, as you're saying. Whether there's a particular natural progression, I'll sort of leave that to you. I haven't thought about it in that way. But it becomes, you know, the very definition of our movement between stages of life. And the thing that we don't think about is that, or is thought about less, is that the structures and some of the very companies and structures don't have those kinds of life cycles. They are around for 50 and 100 years. So it's very different. By the time you get the language and understanding and perhaps a mind that you could sort of turn around and look back on yourself and say, gosh, I was really caught up in all those goods and I don't know why I was like that, it's too late. You've already sort of, you know, you and millions like you in your cohort have already filled the pockets of these same people who are now doing it to the next cohort. So childhood is a way that consumer capitalism reproduces itself on a grand scale.
Jim, I have a question for you. We've only got 5-6 minutes left, so there's a lot on my list. I've gone with like 2 out of 12 things, but hearing you talk and reading your book, I'm just curious, where does political democracy, social justice, issues like that factor in to sort of your equation? Because they don't seem to play a large role in sort of meeting human. You know what I mean? Meeting human needs. Doesn't show up too much, but that doesn't mean you aren't thinking about it.
No, help me out. You have to tell me what specifically.
Well, you know, how important is political democracy for human happiness and for human? How important is that as a value? So if people have a choice of a jacuzzi or living in a free and democratic society, not that we'd be given that choice, but when I hear you talk, that didn't even show up.
Yeah,
the choice is the jacuzzi and, you know, hey, otherwise all systems go.
You know,
I mean, people are basically demoralized socially or at least depoliticized in that sense, that traditional sense. That's just not a really – that's not even in the same league. I mean, it's religion, then consumption, and everything else is in the suburbs. Is that inaccurate?
I don't know. You know, you're right. I really draw a blank when I come to the happiness argument.
Yeah, it's actually a very interesting discussion in the book, I must say. Yeah. For those who are listening to Jim talk, who are thinking, and I think you've made it clear you're not some sort of apologist for the advertising industry.
No, I'm not.
The discussion in the last chapter of Living It Up, which is the title is like a mild defense of luxury, has a very good discussion of happiness. And you're quite candid that there's no evidence that consumption of luxury goods produces happiness.
I mean, no, but there is a lot of evidence.
If you aren't allowed to consume, it makes you unhappy.
That's right. I mean, the here is the reason
take
why.
Take away this, Bill Gates' yacht and, boy, you're going to really see someone get PO'd.
Here's the reason why this culture has got to focus itself on the poor. If the material world is carrying meaning, then the poor lose out twice. First, they don't get the object. And really, more wicked. And they don't
alert
get the meaning.
The FBI. The socialist is returning.
Yeah, well, it's this whole happiness argument. It's not really happiness that makes that's the pivot here. It's meaning. Where do we get life meaning? And you may not like it, but we get life meaning, a lot of it, especially when we're young, through the consuming of stories that are attached to such incredible things as meat patties or toys. Or I don't know what they are, but that's the focus. It's the happiness argument is a real red herring for me.
Mm-hmm.
But the meaning argument, that's crucial.
How about political advertising, which is this booming enterprise? Yeah. Now, it takes the same storytelling that we humans need, and it applies it to the people who are going to make decisions about whether the planet survives.
Yeah, my view is that we get inoculated to advertising real quick. And this is Dan and I could do a whole show on this. My suspicions are that
can you do 4 minutes on it?
I can do we could do 4 hours on this. You know, you watch kids as they go into Toys R Us, they go crazy because they really believe, as the advertising has told them, this is the way the kid. Then they get around 8 years old, you watch them in Toys R Us. Ooh, wait a minute, they've already been able to decode it. Watch them at 12, they know this thing doesn't work as advertised. I think in political advertising, we've had so much of it, we're pretty well inoculated. We even know when the nasty part of campaigns, we even know when dirty tricks are occurring. Not to say that we shouldn't be concerned, but it should be the subject of kind of discussion. Oops, here we go. Now we're into the dirt. Very little of it, really, when people study it, gets through. Maybe we should be like Scandinavians. Maybe we should say no political advertising. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to I'm willing to countenance this as an alternative. No advertising to kids, no political ads. My view is kids and voters learn quick, real quick. Which is why 99% of advertising is just total waste.
So why no one votes, too?
Well, I mean, a lot of the reasons I don't vote is because politics has become like machine-made objects, interchangeables. Mm-hmm. So we don't see enough difference. Well, there isn't enough difference.
Mm-hmm. Dan, do you want to chip in on that?
Politics has become like interchangeable parts, no doubt. Again, I want to sort of jump out of the frame and think about also the tremendous focus of resources within, say, our country and sort of around the world, and where these could be going somewhere else if companies and corporations didn't feel it necessary to tell all these stories in such elaborate ways. And we know it isn't just in words. We know it's in music. We know it's in packaging. We know it's in all these other sorts of things. If we were not in such dire competition for these kinds of stories that others might come out.
All right. Well, we've only got a few minutes left today with Dan Cook and Jim Twitchell. And I think we want to talk now, if we can, in the last couple of minutes about your favorite city in the United States, and certainly one of my favorites, Las Vegas, Nevada, which you devote a chapter to in this book. Have you read Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death?
Yes, I have.
Because Neil, of course, starts, and your arguments are very similar, although his emphasis is upon the technology of television. It's very much a McLuhan-esque argument. But in certain core respects, I think there's considerable similarity, although his is, I think, somewhat more critical in general tone and less sort of, I wouldn't use the term apologetic, but less sort of
accepting
of the status quo. I mean, his is quite critical because I think he's hung up in those things like democracy and social justice that get in the way.
But clearly, I'm not hung up.
Well, apparently,
No, I am. I am not hung up.
No.
Somebody else can do that. That's not my chore.
But Neil also, like, you know, he said, you know, people often talk about America. They talk about Boston or New York or San Francisco or even L.A., but the only city that really captures the essence of this country is Las Vegas. What are your thoughts?
It's what we have for Florence. Now, I'm sure I'm going to shovel coal in hell for saying that, but if you look at Florence and if you look at Vegas, you can see some incredible similarities.
Don't they even have like a miniature Florence in Vegas?
Oh, of course they do. What are the great eruptions of luxury? It's the Bellagio. And then it's the Venetian. And what's inside the Venetian? It's absolute picture-perfect mimicry of bits and pieces of Florence.
Yeah, but, you know, it's even more so true. And I don't know, Dan, have you been to Las Vegas? I was there a couple years ago, and I wanted to go for exactly this reason. But you've got this strip that's completely garish. It's just an ode to consumption and self-indulgence. I mean, nothing like you've ever seen before, of these massive hotels and buildings, miniature Eiffel Towers and the works. And then you get off it, and you get into this extraordinary poverty in very short order. And, you know, you've got this enormous immigrant community working at terrible wages. So, I mean, it's actually a representative city beyond, mm-hmm. you know, the mm-hmm. way we think of it. It really tells us.
And it would not exist without the fact that each and every one of those casinos, like each and every church in the Holy Roman Empire, was giving exactly the same service. Change one of those casinos, let them have different odds, the entire city would fall apart. It's mm-hmm. all based on an advertising principle of fungibility. When mm-hmm. you have interchangeability, you'll get stories. That's what those casinos are. They're stories. That's all they are.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, at this moment, I hear the band tuning up in the background. It's time for us to check out. I would like to thank Dan Cook, Jim Twitchell for being my guest today in Media Matters. It's really been a pleasure having you both here. I'm Bob McChesney. I'm your host in Media Matters. We will be back 1 week from today, 167 hours with another show. I'd like to thank Ben Scott for being my producer. Good day.